You're listening to Feedback with Bill Saunders on News Talk 830 WEEU and 830WEEU.com. A new generation of talk.
Good morning and welcome to the Friday edition of Feedback, your on-air town square here on the Voice of Berks and Beyond, 830 WEEU. Good morning, everyone. I'm Bill Saunders along with Sean Tansky. Our phone number is here if you want to take part in the conversation and share your opinions with everyone. It's 610-374-8800 or toll-free 888-401-0459. But if you prefer to send your opinion to us in another form, there's the text capability. And that dedicated text line is 484-650-3373. Or you can email us at feedback at 830WEEU.com. All right, let's take a look at today's top three topics. Pennsylvania's next legislative body in Harrisburg could be decided by only a few voters in this election. We'll explain why. Climate change concerns are growing. Yet few think President Biden's climate law, known as the Inflation Reduction Act, will help. That's according to a new poll that's out, and we'll talk about that in a bit. And Israel strikes back at Iran. And at 10 o'clock, Dr. Timothy Blessing, a history professor at Alverni University, joins me for a discussion on third-party candidates and how they can muddle an election. And at 11 o'clock, it's the monthly edition of Tooth Talk with Dr. Eric Angstad of Angstad Family Dental. Today, Dr. Angstad talks about how easy it is to get quality dental care in 2024, and he'll be taking your questions today during the 11 o'clock hour. Okay, that's what we're going to focus on today, so let's get into the details, why not? Let's start with this story about how the vast majority of Pennsylvania legislative races will effectively be decided during the primary. It's an article that appears in Spotlight PA, Spotlight PA, their articles appear in multiple newspapers across the state. This one written by Kate Huang Poo, and that's the headline of her article. Vast majority of PA legislative races will effectively be decided during Tuesday's primary. So here's what Kate writes in her column. Millions of voters across the political spectrum will have little choice this year in who represents them in the state House and Senate, thanks to a lack of competitive state legislative districts coupled with Pennsylvania's closed primary system. This, in a way, fits in with what we're going to talk about with Dr. Blessing in the next hour. That combination leaves ultimate control of the legislature and its policy agenda in the hands of a small minority of the population of the state. The races for just 14% of the 228 seats on the ballot this year are expected to be competitive, 29 in the state House and 3 in the state Senate. Only 1.9 million of Pennsylvania's 8.7 million voters live in those districts. The candidates who will hold the vast majority of seats will effectively be decided during partisan, low-turnout primary elections, which takes place this coming Tuesday. That's because most legislative districts have a strong partisan lean toward Democrats or Republicans. Pennsylvania also has a closed primary system, and we've talked about that quite a bit on this show, meaning only Democrats and Republicans can participate in their party's spring elections. That keeps many of the state's 1.3 million unaffiliated and third-party voters from having a meaningful say in who represents them in Harrisburg. Technically, according to this Spotlight PA article, independents and third-party voters can switch their registration to the party whose primary they want to participate in up until 15 days before the election. And then they can switch back to their original registration after they voted. At stake is control of the 203-member state House and 50-member state Senate. Only half of the latter chamber's seats are on the ballot this year. The party that controls each chamber will decide what legislation will be prioritized or blocked during the next two-year session. Democrats won a one-seat state House majority in 2022 after more than a decade of being out of power. Now, that victory hinged on a handful of races that were decided by only a few hundred votes. And we're going to talk in the next story I'm going to share with you, that one vote advantage, that one seat advantage that they hold now is in jeopardy. And I'll explain why in just a bit. Republicans, meanwhile, have controlled the state Senate for decades. But Democrats think they have an opportunity to at least tie the chamber this year. Despite the high stakes, fewer voters are expected to get a significant say in determining the balance than just a few years ago. The number of competitive legislative districts in Pennsylvania fell after the 2020 redistricting process, from 58 down to 38. The commission that drew the maps had to follow certain constitutional requirements, including one that calls for equal population in each district, while contending with population trends. Pennsylvania's rural areas lost people, while urban and suburban areas gained them. People also choose to live around people who they believe have similar political views, so says Chris Fowler, a professor of geography at Penn State, who served on former Democratic Governor Tom Wolf's Redistricting Advisory Council. The demographic pattern concentrates Democrats and Republicans in different pockets of the state and makes it harder to draw competitive districts, according to this Spotlight PA article. Sorting does shape the political landscape, Fowler said. All right, so, yeah, we're going to touch on this with Dr. Blessing in the next hour, but that's rather chilling, if you, for lack of a better way of putting it, that in this go-round, this election cycle, a few people are really going to decide what legislative agenda we're going to be faced with for the next 2 years. That's assuming that there's going to be a low turnout this year, and if history is any guide, chances are it will be a low turnout. They typically are. So we'll stay on top of that and see how things shape up after Tuesday's election. Now, I mentioned a moment ago, and we talked about this the other day in reference to another story that is going on in the state now, where that one-seat advantage the Democrats hold in the state House could be in jeopardy. And I have an update on that story that I got from the Inquirer just before we went on air this morning. They're reporting that a top House Democratic leader took a first step yesterday toward expelling State Representative Kevin Boyle from the state House, as the lawmaker faces criminal charges and his family says he's suffering from a serious mental health condition. House Majority Leader Matt Bradford, a Democrat from neighboring Montgomery County, in response to Boyle's situation, introduced a resolution yesterday to create a new process for expulsion based on a member's incapacity to fulfill duties. The action comes less than a week before the primary election and is an extraordinary step because removing Boyle, who is a Democrat, would temporarily endanger his party's narrow majority in the House. Philadelphia police issued a warrant for Boyle's arrest on Tuesday for allegedly violating a protection from abuse order. Well, as of last evening, Boyle had not turned himself in. Despite the potential House action and the legal case against him, Boyle will remain on Tuesday's primary ballot. His Democratic primary challenger, Sean Dougherty, has the backing of party leaders. Bradford's resolution would change House operating rules to create a new expulsion process by forming a five-member subcommittee of top legislative leaders from both parties to investigate whether a member is unable to fulfill duties as a state representative. The subcommittee would decide whether the member suffers a temporary or permanent impairment, whether physical or mental, that makes the person unable to discharge the duties of office, according to the resolution that Mr. Bradford has put together. The committee would also consider substance abuse or other cognitive impairments. If Boyle were expelled, House Democrats would not have the 102 votes they needed to pass bills along party lines. They could hold a special election 60 days after the expulsion to fill the seat. With such a narrow majority, Democrats had previously chosen not to meet during the two-month period of a vacancy, stopping up any legislative work for months. Now, that to me doesn't seem right. But anyway, that's what they've chosen to do in the past. But this action comes as the June 30th state budget deadline is looming. And it's not immediately clear how House leaders, meaning the Democrats that are in charge, would handle such a vacancy. The State House last expelled a member, Representative Leonard Sweeney of Allegheny County, in 1975, according to the Spotlight PA article, after he was convicted of mail fraud, and only 15 members have been expelled from the House since 1683. Again, I'm sorry, I said Spotlight PA article, I meant Inquirer article, and they got their figures from WGAL in Lancaster. Interesting, and we'll keep on top of that and see how that turns out. But again, according to the last published report, Representative Boyle is still on the run from that arrest warrant. And then there's this. Israel did follow through on what they've been telling people they would do, even though the rest of the world said don't. Israel decided to strike back at Iran. Here's what CNN reports. Israel has carried out a military strike inside Iran, and this is blasts were heard near the city of Isfahan. I hope I'm pronouncing that right, Isfahan, early this morning in a potentially escalatory move Iranian government officials have so far sought to play down. The U.S. has given advance notification Thursday of an intended Israeli strike in the coming days, but did not endorse the response, according to a senior U.S. official. Iran's air defense systems were activated in several locations after three explosions were heard close to a major military air base near the Iranian city of Isfahan, state media reported early this morning. Iranian officials said air defenses intercepted three drones and there were no reports of a missile attack. Iran has not identified the source of the strike, though. Multiple state-aligned news agencies reported that sites associated with Iran's nuclear program were secure and the attack appeared to be limited in scope. Reports of today's strike came hours after Iran's foreign minister told CNN that if Israel takes any further military action against Iran, its response would be immediate and at a maximum level. Those were his exact words. Meanwhile, FBI Director Christopher Wray is a warning of potential threats against Jews ahead of Passover. This from Axios. The FBI is on alert for potential threats against Jews ahead of the start of Passover, which begins next week. The FBI has reportedly warned of increased threats against Jewish and Muslim Americans since the start of the Israel-Hamas war on October 7th. Director Wray told Jewish community security officials on Wednesday the Bureau is particularly concerned that lone actors could target gatherings and events or religious locations over the holiday. Wray says the number of anti-Jewish hate crime investigations opened by the FBI has at least tripled since the start of the Israel-Hamas war compared to the 4 months before October 7th. He added that he's hard-pressed to think of a time where elevated public safety and national security threats occurred at once. And then there's this. The more I hear about what's going on in the UN, I have to wonder, are they really friendly to the United States anymore? Or should we just stop participating in the UN? This from Reuters. The United States yesterday effectively stopped the United Nations from recognizing a Palestinian state by casting a veto in the Security Council to deny Palestinians full membership of the world body. It vetoed a draft resolution that recommended to the 193-member UN General Assembly that the state of Palestine be admitted to membership of the UN. Britain and Switzerland abstained, while the remaining 12 council members voted yes. The United States continues to strongly support a two-state solution. This vote does not reflect opposition to Palestinian statehood, but instead is an acknowledgement that it will only come from direct negotiations between the parties. Those are the words of Deputy U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Robert Wood, who told that to the Council. Palestinians President Mahmoud Abbas condemned the U.S. veto in a statement as unfair, unethical, and unjustified. Palestinian U.N. Ambassador Riyad Mansour, at times emotional, told the council after the vote, and I quote here from this Reuters piece, "The fact that this resolution did not pass will not break our will, and it will not defeat our determination. We will not stop in our effort." The Palestinian push for full UN membership came 6 months into a war between Israel and Palestinian militants Hamas in the Gaza Strip, and as Israel is expanding settlements in the occupied West Bank, which the UN considers to be illegal. Israel's foreign minister, Israel Katz, commended the United States for casting a veto. Addressing the 12 council members who voted in favor of the draft resolution, Israel's UN ambassador said the following, "It's very sad because your vote will only embolden Palestinian rejectionism even more and make peace almost impossible." I'd love to get your thoughts on the UN's actions. And what are your thoughts on the UN overall? Are they still a body that we should continue to participate in and help finance or not? Our numbers here are 610-374-8800 or toll-free, 888-401-0459. The text line is 484-650-3373. We're going to take a break, and then we'll be back with more of this Friday edition of Feedback. You're on Air Town Square in just a bit. Stay with us.
News you can use.
I feel more informed when I listen.
News Talk 830, WEEU.
Welcome back to Feedback on this Friday morning. Phone numbers here are 610-374-8800, toll-free, 888-401-0459. The president says he has done the most out of any other president to address climate change. Well, even though climate change concerns are growing among people in this country, a new poll that's out says that few of those people think that Biden's climate law, known as the Inflation Reduction Act, which, again, I will say has absolutely nothing to do with inflation, and I think our economy is showing it had nothing to do with inflation. They say that that law really is not helping. This from the Associated Press. And the poll is from the Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs Research, and it shows that 45% of adults in the United States say they have become more concerned about climate change over the past year, including roughly 6 in 10 Democrats and 1/4 of Republicans. President Biden's signature climate change policy, the Inflation Reduction Act, was intended to address some of those fears, investing billions in incentives for consumers and businesses to move toward clean energy sources. Biden has pointed to this climate agenda as a major presidential success during his run for re-election. But the polls suggest that although the law has already affected some Americans, it's not widely known among the general population and may not be the electoral boost that Biden is looking for, according to the AP. About 1/4 of Americans say tax credits for renewable energy projects, such as wind power, have benefited people like them so far. Yeah, only 1/4 of Americans. With similar numbers for incentives for companies to manufacture clean energy technologies here in the United States rather than abroad, tax credits for individuals to add solar panels to their homes, or subsidies and tax credits for electric vehicles and energy-efficient appliances like heat pumps. Those numbers are fairly substantial for a law that passed less than 2 years ago, where the benefits largely hinge on big-ticket purchases like cars or home improvements. Promoting electric vehicles has also been a major focus for the Biden administration, and 15% of U.S. adults say electric vehicles have had a good impact on them personally. 15%. But the people who say they benefited from the law are disproportionately Democrats. And while only about 1 in 10 U.S. adults think the individual tax credits and subsidies have hurt people like them, those provisions of the law aren't yet registering with the majority of Americans. Roughly one quarter say those credits haven't made a difference to people like them. Nearly 4 in 10 in each instance don't know enough about an opinion, don't know enough to have an opinion about them, that is. Generally, U.S. adults also aren't confident that the IRA, the individual retirement, Inflation Reduction Act bill is what I'm trying to say there, will have an impact even in wartime. The poll found that only between 23 and 35% of U.S. adults surveyed say the law's key components will eventually help address climate change. About 2 in 10 think the main provisions of the law will make no difference in addressing climate change. And about a third of those surveyed don't know enough to say. A lot of the public feeling on it is, well, something needs to be done. But not necessarily knowing what needs to be done, or not even necessarily having strong feelings about what needs to be done. So says David Weckham, a University of Connecticut professor emeritus. And one of Biden's major pitches for the IRA, again, that is Inflation Reduction Act, why he named it that, or why Congress named it that, who knows? It's totally confusing, and that might be a big reason why they're having this communication problem with the public. Why name it Inflation Reduction Act when it had absolutely nothing to do with that? Anyway, back to this last paragraph here. But one of Biden's major pitches for the IRA, that it will help the American economy and U.S. workers, doesn't seem to be resonating with the public. According to this poll, only about 2 in 10 Americans say the law has done more to help the U.S. economy, while about one quarter think it's done more to hurt the economy. Count me in on that. And about half think it either made no difference or they don't know enough to say. So this is not good, especially when it's a major part of the president's campaign theme there, that and Bidenomics. I mean, both of them are turning out to be losers for him. Losers from the standpoint that people don't understand exactly what he's done. And when it comes to Bidenomics, you're talking about a high inflation rate, high prices that people are suffering from. Look at the gas pump. My goodness, just Wednesday, I was saying that a gas station I pass had gone from $3.35 a gallon a few weeks ago to $3.79 a gallon on Wednesday. This morning, it's at $3.89 and getting ever so closer to that $4 mark. Not the direction the president wants to go in. And guess what, Mr. President? Because of your past actions, you can't, I guess he could deplete the Strategic Petroleum Reserve further to try and lower those prices before November gets here. But good luck with that. All right, enough of that. All right, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about Trump's hush money trial that is going to get started on Monday. Yeah, they now have a jury. They had some problems finding people who could be unbiased. Yeah, I'm still not convinced that the jury is totally unbiased. I say that about any jury. You know, you've got people who say, oh, yeah, I can be impartial. And you know darn full well they probably can't. We're all human, after all. But, yeah, we do have a jury in this case now, and the trial will start on Monday. So, is it a slam dunk like the Democrats think it is? We'll see what the BBC has to say when feedback continues in a bit.
Serving Collegeville, North Wales, King of Prussia, and all of Montgomery County. This is News Talk 830 WEEU.
The voice of Berks and Beyond. Thank you.
Welcome back to Feedback. We'll go to the phones in just a bit, but I want to share this with you that the BBC is reporting. Every once in a while, it's nice to read what publications in other countries have to say about what's going on here. And so this one pertains to the hush money trial that is set to begin on Monday up there in New York City, and the first criminal trial for Donald Trump. So here's what the BBC is reporting. Donald Trump's very first criminal trial, and the first of a former U.S. president, involves charges of white-collar crime, but it features some of the most eye-catching details in any of the four criminal cases against him. The case revolves around a $130,000 hush money payment from Mr. Trump's lawyer to adult film actress Stormy Daniels, who claimed she had an affair with Trump in 2006. But that payment was not actually illegal. Instead, the blockbuster case, bringing 34 felony charges, is based on allegations the former president falsified business records to cover up the payment, made just before the 2016 election to avoid an embarrassing sex scandal, which he denies. So in other words, Stormy Daniels threatens to go to the press with this story and demands payment so that she doesn't go to the press, and it's Donald Trump who's facing charges. Okay. Are you with me so far? The trial, which began in November, or in New York, on April 15th, has legal experts divided on the strength of the case. Some debate whether Manhattan's District Attorney Alvin Bragg, who is a Democrat, should have even brought the case, and whether it's strong enough. Ambrosio Rodriguez, a former prosecutor who says he's no fan of the former president, believes the case legitimizes Mr. Trump's ongoing argument that he's being prosecuted unfairly because of who he is. Mr. Rodriguez argues that the case relies on old allegations, noting that federal prosecutors had investigated and declined to bring charges. This is a waste of time and a bad idea and not good for the country, he told the BBC. This seems just a political need and want to get Trump no matter what the costs are. Others disagree. Nick Ackerman, who worked on the Watergate prosecution, says it's a serious case. Here's what he told the BBC. This is about an effort to defraud the American voters in 2016 to keep them from learning material information that would have affected their vote, referring to Mr. Trump's alleged efforts to hide payments, reimbursing his then-lawyer, Michael Cohen. The case also has come under scrutiny because it's seemingly built on an untested legal theory. Mr. Trump faces 34 felony counts of falsifying business records. New York prosecutors say Mr. Cohen paid off Ms. Daniels and accused Mr. Trump of trying to disguise the money he paid him back as legal fees. Ordinarily, falsifying business records is considered a misdemeanor or low-level offense in New York. But when it's done to conceal a crime, it can be elevated to a more serious felony charge. It's not unusual for the Manhattan District Attorney's Office to do that, but Mr. Bragg's approach is a particularly novel one. He says Trump Organization records were falsified to conceal or aid criminal activity. But even though the trial begins on Monday, he has not specified the exact crime allegedly hidden. He has, however, given clues. In court filings and interviews, Mr. Bragg has said that Mr. Trump violated both state and federal election laws and state tax laws. Well, here's what Shane Stansbury, a former assistant U.S. attorney in New York's Southern District, had to say. The district attorney's office is not precluded from presenting to the jury a variety of alternative theories on sort of why the records were falsified. But, he adds, it is unclear if a state prosecutor can invoke a federal election crime, as it appears Mr. Bragg intends to do. So that's the BBC's take on this hush money trial that gets started on Monday. All right, let's go to the phones right now. Go to Joey in Reading. Joey, good morning. Welcome to Feedback.
Yes, sir. How are you today?
Fine. How are you doing?
I'm doing just fine.
So what's on your mind?
Well, if you recall, the last, I'll say now it's probably about 15 minutes ago, what you're talking about, the economy, the president, the fuel, and this and that. You remember, recall that?
Oh, yeah. I think I was here when it was said.
I'm just
teasing with you.
that's all right. Hey, I'm thinking the same thing. And those problems are all caused by our president. And if people think that it's helping him, like you said, and you, I guess you chuckled there, and that's what it is. And if people think that he's doing a good job, that the 2%, I think you were saying, and the 1%, it's a win-win thing that our president is causing all this, and it's hurting him. But he's not going to reverse everything. Now, I mean, everything from the border till today, with the prices of this, that, people's income, and my income. And it's just too crazy. And people know what to do, and they should follow that route and not go with the bad things that are happening to us. And if they can't see it, then they're just as blind as the man running our country. That's how I feel. And well, as far as the Trump thing, that's a scam. And if you investigate her background, you know what, and choosing the jury, well, it seems to me they have people out there investigating people who will fit in the jury to get the outcome that Biden wants to hear. Am I right or wrong?
Well, here you've got a choice between a president whose accomplishments the public doesn't see. In fact, they see just the opposite of what he's saying is true about the economy and what he's doing, in this case, what he's doing about the climate. And on the other hand, you've got your other option, who is a man facing multiple criminal charges and could end up in jail. So who are you left to vote for in November? That's the question.
It seems like we're running a voting thing that's one-sided because of somebody putting a curveball in there and pulling the wool over everybody's eyes. It don't make any sense.
Well, let me ask you this, Joey. Are you as tired as I am of when it comes to a presidential election, as has been the case the last couple of years, of holding your nose and voting for the lesser of two evils? I mean, isn't that the way it has been working out ever since 2016, at least?
Yes. Well, you know what? I have a sinus problem, so I usually put my thumb over to one side of my nostril. Because you know who's backing all this up, who's chiming in and doing this and doing that, and this is our outcome. Yeah.
It's pathetic, isn't it?
It's very pathetic.
That this is what we have to choose from.
And if people go with the flow that they think today is where we're going. And the other day I heard Biden say, oh, we need to start and build it from the bottom up. Well, sure, that's what you should do. But he's starting at the top and building up on top of it. He's built a skyscraper of disaster. Am I right?
Well, I'm not going to dispute you. I'm not going to dispute you at all. Well, Joey, thank you. I appreciate you weighing in today and sharing your thoughts.
I just pray for everybody to look on the bright side instead of looking into the fog.
But it's getting more and more difficult to find that bright spot, isn't it?
Yes, sir.
All right, buddy. Joey, thanks for the call. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
All right, bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
The interesting piece that Miranda Devine has in the New York Post today. Do I have enough time to do this before we go to commercial break? Her op-ed piece is titled the following: Deranged Get Trump Democrats Only Boost Ex-President With Their Constant Attacks and Insults. So here's what Ms. Devine has to write. And now, this is the same person who's been writing nonstop about the Hunter Biden probe all the way throughout for the New York Post. But she writes this time, the Get Trump Democrats are beside themselves with glee about the former president being stuck in a Manhattan courtroom for the Stormy Daniels hush money trial while the current president hits the campaign trail. They have taken to calling Donald Trump Hitler pig in emails and text messages among White House staff, campaign aides, and other Democrats close to the administration, so reported Politico on Wednesday. So much for the Joe Biden bringing civility back to politics. That's as believable as his other tall tales, that he stopped inflation and never spoke to his son about overseas business dealings. It must infuriate Biden that all the lawfare that his DOJ and other Democratic prosecutors have flung at Trump has succeeded so far only in turning public sympathy toward the former president and given him a constant media presence. Trump seems to have a knack for turning legal lemons into polling lemonade. Of all the cases to go to trial first, Manhattan DA Alvin Bragg's hush money case is the feeblest and most embarrassing, writes Ms. Devine, for Trump's Democratic persecutors, as well as for Trump himself, as it involves allegations which he denies, that he had an adulterous affair with a porn star and then had his then-lawyer, Michael Cohen, pay her off before the 2016 election to stop her spilling the beans. Bragg has been doing his best to make a silk purse out of a sow's ear by trying to recast the case as being about election interference, in which Trump sought to keep voters in the dark about damaging information, the Daniels payoff, for instance, that could have cost him victory in 2016. The case, the core of it, is not money for sex, Bragg said in a radio interview last year. We would say it's about conspiring to corrupt a presidential election and then lying in New York business records to cover it up, he went on to say. Bragg has declared he was compelled to bring the case because he cannot and will not normalize serious criminal conduct. Now, excuse me while I laugh at that comment, because normalizing criminal conduct is all that Bragg has done since his first day in office, to the great detriment of the residents of the city of New York. In his infamous Day One memo, made public in January of 2022, he directed his office to downgrade felony charges for armed robbery and drug dealing. Instead of getting tough on thugs randomly punching women in the face, Bragg is cracking down on irregular bookkeeping. Here he is, while violent criminals roam the streets of New York seeking 34 felony counts in a case against Trump that is really about a misdemeanor allegation of falsifying business records to conceal the hush money payments. According to Bragg, Trump should have told his accountants to list the $130,000 payments to Daniel as hush money rather than legal fees, which you would think rather defeats the purpose of paying hush money in the first place, writes Ms. Devine. Bragg has creatively transformed this bookkeeping misdemeanor into a felony by alleging the falsification was done to conceal campaign finance violations. His star witness is Cohen, a convicted felon, perjurer, and disbarred lawyer with a pathological hatred of his former boss and a Rolodex stuffed with the most Trump-deranged media figures in the country, such as Don Lemon, Rachel Maddow, and George Stephanopoulos. A curious element of the case is that lawyer Bob Costello, who was briefly Cohen's legal advisor after the Trump fixer was raided by the FBI in 2018, has not been asked to testify on Trump's behalf as a character witness against Cohen. Whatever is going on, Costello is Trump's trump card, and it is inexplicable that he would be left out of the case. Biden let the cat out of the bag when asked about the probes of the Trump the day after the 2022 midterms, when he said his goal was to make sure Trump doesn't take power. "We just have to demonstrate that he will not take power if he runs, making sure he, under legitimate efforts of our Constitution, does not become the next president again." Those were Biden's exact words. The next month, Biden's number three political appointee at the DOJ, Matthew Colangelo, was sent to Bragg's office to run the Trump case. Bragg is a cog in the Democratic attack machine. "That's the real election interference," writes Ms. Devine in the New York Post. And we'll be back in just a bit.
Serving Bethel, Hamburg, Birdsboro, and all of Berks County, this is News Talk 830 WEEU.
Wrap up hour number one of this Friday edition of Feedback here on Air Town Square. Coming up during the 10 o'clock hour, I'm going to be joined by Dr. Timothy Blessing, the history professor from Alvernia University, for a discussion of third-party candidates and their impact on elections. So stick around for that. We'll be taking your questions pertaining to that topic, okay? Welcome back to Feedback. You're on Air Town Square as we continue with the Friday edition of the show here on The Voice of Berks and Beyond, 830 WEEU. Good morning, everyone. I'm Bill Saunders along with Sean Tansky. Our phone numbers here are 610-374-8800 or toll-free 888-401-0459. And our dedicated text line is 484-650-3373. And I'm very happy to welcome my guest this morning, Dr. Timothy Blessing, a history professor from Alvernia University. Tim, good morning. Welcome to Feedback, buddy.
Good morning, and great to be back here.
It is fantastic to have you with us today. And we're going to talk about a very interesting topic. And anybody who calls in with a question, again, up front, I'm going to ask you, as I do every time I'm with Tim, please keep your questions to the topic that we're addressing today. We would appreciate that. And the topic today is an interesting one, and that is the effects that third-party candidates can have on an election, or you use the phrase muddle an election.
That's right.
So share with us why you say they could muddle an election.
Well, what we know is this, is that there's been a series of elections. This dates back to 1824. There's been a series of elections where what happens when you have a serious third-party challenge, We know that the system's about to change. Because what happens is, as say, in the case of 1948, where Harry Truman had to run against Strom Thurmond, had to run against Henry Wallace, had to once run against Dewey, Thomas Dewey, what happened next is the Republicans took over. So Truman had to face two challengers from his own party in the general election, not in the primary, but in the general election.
Right.
And so we get these muddles. What happens is when a party or when a system begins to fall apart like that, is you get all these people who say, well, you know, I represent and I'm strong for, and the party just blows up. And that's what happened to the Democrats, because you're on the eve of the civil rights era. Strom Thurmond runs as a hardcore segregationist, and Henry Wallace runs as a, I think most of his votes came from the Communist and Socialist Workers' Parties and things like that.
Okay.
So so the Democrat, just think Strom Thurmond and Henry Wallace in the same party, that makes no sense whatsoever.
Right.
So the party was about to blow up, which it did.
Mm-hmm.
And that's happened time and time again. The 1992 election with Ross Perot. Ross Perot ran as a populist. Let me think. What's Donald Trump? So what happens is you get these elections where you don't have a clear majority because some third party and or third part plural candidates, some of these candidates come in. They represent a large enough body of voters to indicate that change is about to happen. And of course, the Perot elections were, all the sirens in the country were blowing because he just ran up such a large number of votes. It indicated what was happening, which was that the Republican Party was shattering.
Mm-hmm.
And now, if you happen to be a Nicole Wallace Republican, you're pretty lonely out there.
So share with us in this election coming up, we've got several third-party candidates so far. That we're hearing about in the press who will be running for president in November. Go over those with us.
Well, you know, this gets really complicated, in part because right now there's only one real third-party candidate, and that's Jill Stein, who's running, of course, on the Green Platform, which is an environmental mm-hmm. anti-capitalist platform.
And she did in 2016, too.
And actually probably took at least one state, away from
Clinton, Hillary.
From
uh-huh.
Hillary, yeah.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the margins were paper thin. She might have taken more, but, it's kind of hard to figure out where those votes would go if she hadn't been on the ballot.
Well, she certainly wouldn't have hurt Trump in any way, right?
No. If you can find me a Trump voter who wants to vote for Jill Stein as his backup, I'll take them to dinner. and then, of course, you've got Cornel West, mm-hmm. who is a philosopher,
mm-hmm.
and he has a great stage presence. He is actually, at heart, a Trotskyite. And for those of you who don't know what a Trotskyite is, that is somebody who is of a Marxist bent, let's put it that way,
right.
But who believes in constant revolution, that there's always a new revolution to be had.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I will say this for Cornel West. Of the three main third-party candidates, because you've got others, of the three main third-party candidates, he right now is on four ballots, three plus one. He's on the ballot in in Alaska, in Oregon, in South Carolina, of all places, which just surprised
That's
the heck out of me.
Yeah.
And Utah's about to approve him being on the ballot.
Okay.
And so Cornel West, although he says things sometimes which are fairly libertarian, he really is your true Marxist, rather extreme Marxist candidate that.
Mm-hmm.
In the instance of Robert Kennedy Jr., he has both conservative, libertarian, progressive
ideas. Yeah, a whole hodgepodge
ideas.
Of people.
And of course, he made his name by being a Kennedy who was against vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
But in reality, he has a whole range of issues which he, and they really do divide up into three or four different camps. He's the one who scares the heck out of the Democrats, as well he should.
Why?
Because, first off, the name Kennedy. I mean, mm-hmm. And if you've been paying attention to politics, that people keep bringing that up. But
is that why? Let me stop you there for a minute. Is that why this week members of the Kennedy family got on a stage with Biden,
right.
and threw their support behind him, and had some not so pleasant words to say about their own family member?
Yeah, I mean he's not a Kennedy by marriage like Schwarzenegger.
Right, right.
He's the real thing. And so they did get behind Biden rather vociferously, but the reality is that if you're a Kennedy supporter and you think vaccines are causing autism, and I'm not saying that it doesn't.
I'm with you. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And all these other things like that, you think it's just part of a conspiracy?
Mm-hmm.
That the Kennedys are part of the, of some vast mass of elite who are trying to keep the truth from the American people while paying off Big Pharma. And so if you believe that, you don't care what the other Kennedys say. And there's a whole range of issues where he is basically, you're dealing with, and I know I'm going to get calls from Kennedy supporters out there, but you're really dealing with someone who has managed to accumulate all the conspiracy theories that you could ever want into one political platform.
So why is it then that the Biden camp is worried about him? Because it sounds to me more like Trump supporters would be more likely to lean toward Kennedy than those who would necessarily vote for Biden in November.
I can assure you that Trump is not 100% pleased about Kennedy. Mm-hmm. He's more pleased than Biden is. But here's the trouble. Here's who Kennedy appeals to. And by the way, with Shanahan on the ticket, even more so.
I'm going to get to her in a minute.
Yes.
But go ahead. That's his vice presidential pick.
What has happened is that in the suburbs in particular, which Biden is going to live or die by the suburbs, in the suburbs, you know, you talk about, say, a 42-year-old woman who is a major player in some business. She is quite likely to believe in the same things that Kennedy believes in. So she ascribes to the same conspiracy theories that he does.
Mm-hmm.
And so he is very attractive to that mass of, you know, I realize I'm using the word woman here or women here, but he really is very attractive to that group. Like that. Now, that's not to say that men don't back him too.
No, I'm with you. Uh-huh.
But that's really the situation where Kennedy is appealing to the stories that are being told within the upper middle class and upper class suburbs. And that hurts Biden in two ways. It doesn't hurt Trump much at all. Trump's problems with Kennedy go in a different direction. But not only do you lose their votes, you lose their donations. And I can tell you, my computer is flooded with appeals from Biden. And so far more than Trump.
Mm-hmm.
So that really is Kennedy's attraction. That's Kennedy's base.
Okay.
Now, are there other people are attracted to Kennedy? Yeah, he's got a very pro-industrial, pro-Midwest stance on things. I mean, he has said that the Biden administration is naive in terms of things like heavy-duty industries, heavy manufacturing,
mm-hmm.
and he is, in that sense, stealing Trump's thunder because that's Trump's line.
True.
So, and again, if I am middle class, and I'm choosing between this guy who is, okay, he's got an odd voice, but actually, when I listen to him, I forget about the odd voice.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking to someone who actually does seem like he's talking to you. And, I mean, he's got a gift that way.
Mm-hmm.
Trump can do the
same
thing.
Well, that's the Kennedy way, right?
Yeah, there's the Kennedy way. The Kennedys are some of the most elitist of the elitist, but when they talk to you, you feel like they're your buddies.
That's right, yeah. As far as, and you were talking about who's currently on the ballots or how many states' ballots they're on, mm-hmm. You were talking to me off air that Kennedy right now is what, only on two state ballots?
Only on two. I think the, as you mentioned, I think the closest next one is Colorado, and he's not on. I checked, of course, while we were off the air.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as I can tell from the Secretary of State Office of Colorado, he's not on the ballot right now.
Okay.
So if he can only get on, now there's eight ballots where you just walk in and write in the guy's name. There's eight states where you just write the fellow's name in and that's it. Pennsylvania, by the way, is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Most states make it complicated to do a write-in, but in eight states, and I can't tell you the eight off the top of my head, but in eight states, you literally can just walk in to the booth, write the name in.
You're talking about voters being able to walk into the booth
voters.
And put their name in. Okay.
And put their name in,
mm-hmm.
and that's it. You could consider him on the ballot, but you still have to take that one extra step of pulling back the slot and writing in the name. Going down to the bottom of the ballot, locating where you should sign, you put your write-in. And so even in the states which are automatic write-ins, it's not completely automatic.
Okay. Why is it then, and Jill Stein, you said, is in every state?
Every state. The Green Party has a place regardless of who is nominated. The Green Party has a line on every ballot in every state.
Now, one of the key campaign issues that that Mr. Biden's running on is climate change.
Right.
So why isn't Jill Stein as dangerous, for lack of a better word to come up with right now, to his campaign as Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is.
Well, you know, Joel Stein appeals to the far left wing of the environmental movement, and Biden does not. So if we say, well, it's climate change or it's some other environmental issue, why aren't they voting for Biden? Because Biden. And the thing is the fervor of it. And let me give you an example of this. Biden has said publicly, I'm a capitalist. You will never hear Jill Stein say that.
That's true.
So, and that's where the division is.
Gotcha. Okay. We're going to take a break. My guest this morning is Dr. Timothy Blessing, and we're talking about third parties and their impact on, or more likely, how they can muddle elections. I love that. I love that word that you used. We're taking your questions regarding that very topic. So if you'd like to talk with Dr. Blessing this morning about this topic, feel free to give us a call at 610-374-8800 or toll free 888-401-0459. You're listening to Feedback here on The Voice of Berks and Beyond, 830 WEEU. We'll be back in just a bit.
Serving Paoli, Glenmore, Coatesville, and all of Chester County. This is News Talk 830 WEEU.
And now back to Feedback with Bill Saunders on 830 WEEU, the voice of Berks and Beyond.
Welcome back to Feedback here on Air Town Square, here on the voice of Berks and Beyond, 830 WEEU. And my guest this morning is Dr. Timothy Blessing, a history professor from Alvernia University. And we're talking about third parties and how they can muddle an election. And we are taking your calls on that very topic this morning, 610-374-8800 or toll free, 888-401-0459. Dr. Blessing, if you could, for just a little bit, share with us a little bit of history as to what created the challenges for third-party candidates to get on the ballot that we were talking about in the first segment here.
Well, you, just getting onto a ballot as a third party, many states make it extremely hard. And in fact, I don't know if you've read this, Bill, but it's true. Biden may be a third-party candidate in Ohio.
I did hear that.
Yes, simply because... And I don't want to insult blithering idiots, but simply because the blithering idiots who are setting up the Democratic National Committee set it up at the wrong time.
Well, Louisiana too, right?
I don't know about Louisiana, to be truthful.
Because there were two states that that told him that, Ohio and Louisiana.
So unless the Ohio legislature, which is dominated by Republicans and have no reason to help Biden, so unless their legislatures, but both states are dominated by Republicans, they have no real reason to change their rules for Joe Biden.
Right.
So he could literally end up being a third-party candidate. So in order to get on as a third-party candidate in most states, now this might not apply to Alaska, in most states, what you have to do is you have to get enough signatures, verified signatures, of registered voters to get and submit it by a certain date to get on the ballot. Now, that's in most states. And the problem with that is my name is Tim Harry Blessing, and I have no idea what it looks like on my voter registration. I haven't looked at it in years. But I'm used to signing myself in as Tim H. Blessing. Well, if I sign myself as Tim H. Blessing, who lives at the right address as Tim Harry Blessing, if I sign Tim H. Blessing, I'll be stricken.
Oh, wow.
And the rule of thumb is you need about four times as many signatures on the things that you're signing, where you're saying that you want someone to be on the ticket. You need about four times as many signatures as you need because they are going to be attacked relentlessly. And that takes us, by the way, to the redoubtable person. I hope some members of your audience have heard of Mark Elias. Mark Elias may be simply the greatest election attorney that has ever existed. He is a Democrat. Mm-hmm. The Democrats pay him very well to challenge Republicans and third-party candidates and those folks, and also to bend election laws if he can, and he usually can. And so what happens is that people, they get enough signatures, and then he will search through the election laws, he and his firm will research through election laws and find out that you had to have them written in a certain order or something like that and throw all the signatures out. So he's extremely good at gaming the system. And it is very difficult for a non-Democrat to get past Elias.
Why is what he's doing not considered election interference?
I think it is election interference. But technically, he is following the letter of the law, and he forces everybody else to follow the letter of the law. And you know, the law has a lot of gray areas in it. If you don't agree with Elias's interpretation of a gray area, you're probably not going to get on the ballot.
Do the Republicans have their own version of this attorney?
No. In fact, Trump has said on a number of occasions now just how messed up, and I agree with him on this, the Republican National Committee is. They are, I would say, 12 years at least behind the Democrats in terms of understanding what modern election law allows you to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so they, under the recently departed chair of the RNC, the Republicans simply were flailing. Now that he's put one of his own people, one of his own relatives,
Laura Trump.
Yeah, Laura Trump, in charge of the RNC, I don't know if that's going to improve or not. But certainly, there's no question that if you're a third-party candidate, and you're a serious third-party candidate, you're going to run into Elias. Unless you're, if he thinks that you're going to take away for the Democrats, you are in for a real treat in terms of electioneering. I might point out that there are other third-party candidates too, because you have the Constitutional Party,
mm-hmm.
Other parties like that. You mentioned one that I didn't know of when we were
Freedom Party.
The Freedom Party.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, which actually apparently is going to field candidates.
Mm-hmm.
So, which I think, by the way,
not for president,
not
though.
For president.
Not at least not this year. They're saying.
Yeah. So you know there are a host of small parties. Here's a piece of trivia for you. After 120 years, the Women's Christian Temperance Party has finally elected a candidate to an office.
Who's that?
It was some low-lying, county-level office.
Oh, my goodness.
But that's the first one anywhere in the country that a WCTU candidate has been elected.
Well, let's see. Let's go to the phones for a moment and get some questions from our listeners. Jim in Stony Creek has a question for you. Jim, good morning. Welcome to Feedback today.
Morning, Bill. How are you today?
I'm fine. How are you doing?
Just driving today, heading up to Carlisle to the big car show. So we're gonna
have fun, buddy. Have fun.
Yeah, I'm gonna try. So my question for Dr. Blessing is: in this day and age where they don't teach cursive to kids anymore, what happens when you get your petition and it says signature and they can't sign?
Oh, that's
going to be considered a soft. What do they call it? They call them soft and hard for the problems on petitions. Which is that going to be? Or are they going to let them slide?
Good question.
If your signature, you just have a signature card. If your signature on the ballot doesn't correspond to the one on the signature card, you're out.
On a petition. When you are getting signatures on your petition to run for office,
right?
It says you print your name and then it says signature. If they can't sign their name and they print their name, will that be allowed?
And there's two different answers to that. The first one is that if they can't affirm that in some way whatever looks like a signature is your signature, and I know a fellow who signs a signature by making a zero and then drawing two lines through it. He's a professor, I know. If they cannot affirm that that's your signature, you're out. But there's something else. There's a way around that, and that is this. Is to make an X and have someone attest to it, you're not required to be. You're not required to be literate in this country,
right?
So as a result, If you if you make a mark, as my friend does with the zero and the lines through it, which I just can't figure out, and somebody is there to attest that that's your signature, then that's your signature. But it all really comes down to that signature card. Can you make a signature on the card? And if not, you should just make an X and have someone attest to it.
That's a little difficult when you're going door-to-door trying to get your signatures on your petition.
Absolutely. And sometimes in some states you have to have that notarized. So it's not easy. My signature has changed a little over the years. I've gone lazy about writing the end of the blessing. It's more like a straight line.
That's the way mine is too.
Yeah. So it may be that, I would sign a signature and they'd say, well, this isn't the Tim blessing we know. Unless you're almost better off making an X and having someone attest to it. But certainly they throw out bushels of signatures because people do change signatures over the years.
Yeah.
And it is more common than not to have a signature thrown out. So the majority of signatures, sometimes and as high as 75% of signatures will be thrown out.
Wow. Jim, thanks for the call. Appreciate it.
Wait. I have one more quick question.
All right, real quick.
The other question is, in this day and age of Ring doorbells where no one wants to answer their door, making it extremely difficult to get your signatures, is there, at some point, are they going to have to change election laws other than going door to door to get your petition signed?
My answer to that is going to be rather cynical. I don't know why either Republicans or Democrats would make it easier for a third-party candidate to challenge him.
I'm not referring to a third party. I'm just referring to anybody. I mean, it's getting more and more difficult because when you get to a lot of houses and they have a Ring doorbell in there and they just won't answer. You can hear them inside watching TV. They just won't answer the door.
Yeah, I understand the point you're making. Let's say that I'm a Republican. And I've been a Republican for X number of years. I'm an office holder. It's very easy for me to get the appropriate forms filled out. If I'm a newcomer, not so easy. And so most of the time, this isn't really an issue if you're a Democrat or a Republican. In fact, I'm trying to think. I know that back in the old days, I had some candidates challenged. But it's not a common thing if you're a Democrat or Republican. But if you're a third party, then it gets complicated.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Jim, thank you for your call. Appreciate your questions this morning. Let's go to Matt in Chillington. Matt, good morning. Welcome to Feedback.
Good morning, gentlemen. First a rhetorical question, then my regular question. Gentlemen, do you think Robert Kennedy will be invited to Thanksgiving dinner at the Kennedy clan? And if he does go, will they agree not to discuss politics or religion for dinner?
I can't imagine a gathering of the Kennedys which doesn't talk about politics.
For sure. Dr. Blesky, I'm a little embarrassed myself. I should remember this, but I don't. 1992 election. Mm-hmm. I'm looking over the results here. Popular vote, Clinton 45 million, Bush 39 million, Perot 20 million.
Right.
Clinton won 32 states, which turned into a rout in the Electoral College, 370 to 168. My two-part question, Doctor, as people discussed this at the time, did Perot draw voters, do you think, from Bush? And do you recall, was an argument made at the time, Perot cost Bush's reelection there? Well, what was the demographic, so to speak, then? And then I did have one follow-up with that.
And I'll tell you, if you look at the state where Perot did the best, which was Kansas, if you look at that state, that's not your suburban urban state. That's a rural state. That's a populous state. It's been a populous state since the 1800s. I have actually done analysis. I've done papers on this particular topic, and there's no question in my mind that had Ross Perot not been in the field, Bush would have been reelected.
I got that impression, as well. And the last one, then I'll hang up, Bill, make room for someone else. I'm trying to remember, what was it that got him 20 million votes? Was any particular issues, maybe the budget or something? But what do you think, what was the attraction of Ross Perot to get 20 million votes, okay?
Well, I'm going to give you an official answer, and then I'm going to give you the real answer. The official answer is that Ross Perot stressed control of the southern border as to trade, NAFTA, if you remember. And he was very much a protectionist candidate. And, of course, then that got him votes in the upper Midwest and got him some votes here in Pennsylvania. He didn't do that badly in Pennsylvania. But the real thing about Perot is the thing that really got him all those votes is the fact that he was a thumb in the eye to the establishment. He basically is a herald of Donald Trump. And people voted for him because, for whatever reason, they were sick and tired of what they thought was going on. You notice I'm kind of using some words of caution in there. I don't know that Perot voters had high information basis, and I don't. And I realize I just insulted some of your audience, Bill. But what the heck? I was married to someone in those days who had a Ross or Boss cap, so you know. But I
I'll get the hate mail, not you.
But really, that's it. I mean, Perot, if you look at his performance in the debates, I mean, he was really good, and funny, and he was right in your face with those two guys, and so I think you would have to say that Perot's big attraction was that he wasn't normal, that he wasn't the average run-of-the-mill candidate. When I watched Gavin Newsom out in California, I think, well, there's a guy with all the charisma, and he's saying the same thing everybody else is saying on his side,
right.
Which limits his appeal. The number of votes Gavin Newsom would get out of South Dakota, we could probably get into the studio. So Perot's hard line on the economy was very attractive to people who write newspaper columns. But to the average voter, I think it was just the fact that he was pushing back against people whom they didn't like or trust.
Mm-hmm. Would you say, and we got to go to a commercial here in just a minute, but I mean, you had Ross Perot, who was a businessman,
right.
And Donald Trump, who is a businessman.
Right.
Would you say, how would you compare the two as far as their attraction in politics is
concerned?
Well,
of course, Trump has always been controversial. I mean, I watched, there's over an hour long Phil Donahue show with Trump on it. His stance haven't actually changed that much.
But he was a Democrat, was he not?
He was a Democrat, and then he belonged to the People's Party. And then he switched over. I don't know when he switched over to being a Republican. It may have been fairly late in the game. He, of course, if you're in New York City real estate, you're going to be a Democrat,
Well, that's
by the way.
True, too, yeah.
The thing about Trump, is he is Ross Perot on steroids. Perot was, after all, head of a sprawling international company.
Right.
Trump is head of a real estate empire, if he still has an empire. I'm not sure he does at this moment. And he is obviously used to the camera. And he said, and several people have reported that, he told him this, that when the news cycle is particularly bad for him, he will say something outrageous and change the topic.
Mm-hmm.
So he understands Perot understood media, don't get me wrong, but he really understands media. And if you sit around and watch reporters, you know, they react like dogs. When Trump says something, they react like dogs looking at a steak. They jump off their hind legs and they take a bite, and that's exactly what Trump wants them to do.
So these outrageous statements that Trump makes, it's by design?
Oh, no. Oh, definitely. Definitely. He's got a bad temper, don't get me wrong.
Oh, yeah.
He's got a terrible temper. But, yeah, they are by design. In fact, he has told, let's say, more than 20 people that, you know, he doesn't sleep much. He sleeps 4 or 5 hours a day. That at 4 o'clock, he'll think, you know, the way I can change a topic is if I say this. And if you go back and you look at some of the more outrageous tweets, that's when they occur between 4 and 6 in the morning.
Right.
And that's because he woke up, thought, I've got to change the topic. Here's what I'm going to do.
Oh, wow. All right, we're gonna switch topics in just a bit. Well, we're going to continue talking about third parties when we return. But we're going to go over a couple of states and look at the process of what? Becoming a third-party candidate in those states? Is that what we're going to look at?
Well, what I'd like to do is take a look at what states he could be flipped.
Oh, okay. All right. Sounds good. Sounds like a good plan to me. And we will do that when our conversation with Dr. Timothy Blessing continues on this Friday morning here on Feedback. Stay with us.
And now back to Feedback with Bill Saunders on 830 WEEU, the voice of Berks and Beyond.
Welcome back to Feedback on this Friday morning here on The Voice of Berks and Beyond, 830 WEEU. Our phone number's here. If you have a question for my guest, who is Dr. Timothy Blessing, give us a call at 610-374-8800 or toll free, 888-401-0459. We're talking about third parties and how they can muddle elections. We have a few minutes left, believe it or not. I can't believe how quickly this hour is going by, Tim. But share with us a couple of states that could flip.
Well, you know, first off, everything I say, you've got on the Republican side, you've got the abortion issue.
Mm-hmm.
And on the Democratic side, you have the fact that most Democratic activists seem to have turned their back on Biden due to Israel and Gaza.
Right.
So I'm saying that with that in the background. But I don't think there's any question that Joel Stein and West could easily flip New Hampshire. And in fact, of course, that's New England, and Kennedy comes from New England, so New Hampshire is definitely in play.
Okay.
Arizona. Arizona is the ultimate suburb state. If Kennedy can get on the ballot there, he's got a chance to make his presence known. Can he win it? I doubt it, but certainly. And the same thing goes for Nevada, which is basically Las Vegas with a state attached to it. So you have to think that Nevada's in play. Virginia, and I realize that the commentators are not agreeing on Virginia, but let me tell you what happened in 2021 in Virginia. The MAGA voters voted for a black Hispanic, for a black woman,
mm-hmm.
and voted for a Hispanic Latin attorney general.
Mm-hmm.
So anything could happen in Virginia, and of course the Kennedy name in Virginia is pretty big.
Okay.
So that's an important state. I don't think Maryland's going any place, despite the fact that Hogan's very likely to win the Senate election down there. But Pennsylvania, for goodness sakes, you know, if you talk to the folks on the main line, which I do quite a bit, as a matter of fact, I'm absolutely horrified by things they believe. So they are really open to Kennedy, and of course, Kennedy is going to appeal to the heavy-duty workers out around Pittsburgh. So Kennedy could be a major player here and in Michigan.
Wait a minute. So if I heard you right, you're saying that on the mainland, mm-hmm. the main line, mm-hmm. that there are people who could be voting for Robert Kennedy?
Oh, absolutely. It wouldn't surprise me if he runs up 20% in along the main line. I mean, that area, these are the folks.
I thought they were fairly liberal people there on the main line.
They are fairly liberal, but they are the folks who go along with Kennedy on the vaccine thing. They are the folks. No, I'm not. I'm really not kidding, Bill.
So
Kennedy on the ballot in Pennsylvania could be a disaster for the Democrats. So,
That might explain an article that I saw on Real Clear Politics mm-hmm. for Pennsylvania, where they said that the article was, can Biden lose Pennsylvania?
Well, if Biden loses Pennsylvania, I don't know where he makes up the votes. It's hard to see. The only state that I can see, I can see two states flipping flipping to Biden. One of them is North Carolina, and I'm not sure Trump can ride that out if that happens.
Mm-hmm.
But that's because of Charlotte and Research Triangle area,
mm-hmm.
and Florida, and that's because of the abortion issue.
Mm-hmm.
So, but none of those are characterized by a third-party entry. The third-party damage, with just a slight problem with Kennedy on trade and things such as that for Trump, but the third-party damage is almost certain to occur on the Democratic side, which is why Mark Elias is probably the most important person in the country right now.
What's your take on, and we only have about a minute left here, but what's your take on the typical voters' opinions of the two major parties today? Do you think that what's the frustration level of the average voter today of the two major parties?
Well, I think just of the election process in general, people are fuming. I have colleagues who will be happy that I don't identify them, who I was watching a tape of a Trump rally, mm-hmm. and I suddenly realized that two of my colleagues were there. And I approached one of them, and they almost passed out. And they said, don't tell anyone.
Oh, wow.
So basically, right now, voting for either major candidate is a subversive act. And so it really has gone crazy out there. I've been in this business for over 40 years. I've helped all kinds of political candidates, both left and right, and I have never seen anything like this. I used to compare this election to the 1824 election. Now I'm beginning to compare it to the 1860 because there just isn't any meeting ground. The distance between the two parties is so great that I don't think there is a compromise position. So the Freedom Party is going to have to do it the old-fashioned way and build it up from the roots up.
Mm-hmm.
I think they can do it.
And we'll leave it there.
Okay.
Dr. Blessing, thank you again. Always enjoy having you on the show with us. Looking forward to your next visit already. And we'll talk about what that topic's going to be. Folks, that wraps up hour number two. We'll be back in just a bit with the rest of Feedback Today. Stay with us.
News, weather, and traffic.
It's a source I can trust.
A new generation of talk. News Talk 830 WEEU.
That'll do it for this episode of Feedback. To comment on the show, you can email us at feedback@830weeu.com. You can also hear our show live from 9 a.m. to noon Eastern Time at 830weeu.com or on the TuneIn app. For producer Sean Tansky, I'm Bill Saunders. Thanks for listening.